Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 393. This week, the questions are taken from Guide 460 on naval icebreakers, the Wednesday video on the trial and tribulations of US Navy World War II torpedoes, and the Friday video on German torpedo fuses and how they work. Almirante Brown asks, how much did the icebreaking features installed on Russian dreadnoughts weigh? And would removing those features, or never installing them in the first place, have corrected the forward trim issues on the Gangut-class dreadnoughts? It's difficult to quantify precisely because the nature of the icebreaking bow of the Gangut and some of the other Russian battleships essentially comes down to just a little bit of hull shaping or bow shaping. So from above water, it looks a little bit like it's got a ram going on, even though it's a late 1900s dreadnought. But also the underside of the bow is shaped a little bit more like an icebreaker than you would normally find on a dreadnought. It's not a massive change. There's certainly other dreadnought designs that have a similar, very scalloped bow. But primarily it's the stem, which is the forward part of the bow. So the stem is reinforced. And of course, you also have some additional support because, as you can see, the ship's armor runs all the way bow to stern. Obviously, it's thicker amidships, but yeah, there is some fairly thick plate at the bow particularly. However, that plate is not there strictly to strengthen the bow to make it an icebreaker bow, because as you can see, it runs all the way to the stern, and no one ever accused the Gangut of having an icebreaking stern. That armour layout was far more to do with the Russians trying to proof the ship along the entire waterline against anything other than battleship-grade gunfire. So in the end, we're probably talking maybe low two-digit tons of additional weight in terms of, you know, having a strengthened stem and the fixtures and fittings for it. And some of that weight may actually have been saved, you know, or recovered back by the way the bow is designed. Because if you imagine, if you follow the curve of the bow from underwater upwards to a more clipper-style bow that you might, or even a straight stem that you might expect from other dreadnoughts, that's obviously going to add a little bit of weight. So I don't think it adding or removing that is really going to change all that much. Because, yes, okay, the Gangut did have some trim issues, but their much bigger problem was the fact they finished far too heavy and settled far too deep compared to their design specs. And that's a complication of hundreds of tons of weight. And that's not something slightly reshaping the bow to a more conventional form is going to change. Master Screen asks, I wonder why the 2nd Pacific Squadron included an icebreaker in the first place, as they sailed before the Baltic froze over, and were not going to hit any ice before getting to Japan and the Tsushima Straits. I do recall the captain didn't like Admiral Rozazvansky, and the ship was sent home before the voyage even really got going. Well, two reasons. Firstly, the icebreaker was used in the Baltic as an attempt to sweep mines, so kind of a... They were trying to use it as an auxiliary fleet minesweeper, which made a certain amount of sense, obviously, because icebreakers are pretty strong. So, you know, if there's any ship that's going to accidentally hit and set off a mine that might survive, it would probably be an icebreaker, certainly in 1904. And also, of course, an icebreaker is designed for having extreme amounts of power at low speed. So towing a really, really long minesweeping cable between it and another ship would seem to make a certain amount of sense. You could certainly put a very long cable on it and it would still be able to manoeuvre. Didn't really work out, obviously. Relations did not go well between the icebreaker and Rozazvansky. But there was also a certain amount of logic to it because, yes, although the Baltic didn't freeze over at that stage when they sailed, you've got to remember they did sail in mid-October, and they started out from some relatively northerly ports, and ice does start to form in the Baltic in early October, especially in particularly cold seasons or cold years. So having an icebreaker along just to nudge some early ice formations out of the way was probably a reasonable plan. Plus, of course, there was a non-zero chance that they would have to make for Vladivostok by the time they actually got to the Pacific, which, as it turns out, was actually the case, because they didn't know whether or not Port Arthur would fall, and it did fall while the ships were on their way around the world. And, of course, Vladivostok is a port that will need the services of an icebreaker at some point or another during their stay there, if they ever manage to get there, of course. Hank the Unobtrusive asks, why did the British decide to convert the Almirante Cochrane into a carrier when they must have known that Chile would eventually want the ship back as a battleship after the war? Well, you've got to remember that the hull of Almirante Cochrane, as she was originally known, was sitting in on a slipway for pretty much the entirety of World War One. No further work was being done on her for understandable reasons. And eventually, as opposed to, you know, with Almirante Latouré, a.k.a. in British service HMS Canada, the British had gone to Chile and said, look, we're kind of forcibly requisitioning dash compulsory purchasing this ship right now because we need it. Whereas with Almirante Cochrane, they hadn't done that. She'd just sat as Chilean property, just not being completed due to extenuating circumstances. And then in 1918, the British were thinking, well, we want to build a carrier. Ideally, that means converting from an existing hull. We don't have any existing hulls that could be quickly and easily converted, the ones that they could do, they'd already used up. And then they looked at the slipway and went, hey, well, there's a hull that has been completed up to almost the main deck level. That would be perfect for conversion. Who does that belong to? Oh, it belongs to Chile. Hey, Chile, can we buy your incomplete hull, please? We want to do some stuff to it. And the Chileans kind of say, yeah, might as well. I mean, we're not seeing it anytime soon. So the British formally purchased Almirante Cochrane from the Chileans. Then, obviously, they turned it into HMS Eagle. But then after the war, the Chileans turned around and said, well, you knew we were going to want Latouré back. So, and the British said, fine. But then the Chileans decided, also, we kind of want Almirante Cochrane as well, but we want her as a battleship rather than as a carrier. But the cost to convert Eagle at that stage back into a battleship was far too high. And the British said, sorry, that's actually, for the amount of money you're offering, that's going to cost us far too much. Do you want something else instead? And that's how Chile almost became the proud new owner of a slightly used battlecruiser or two. But in the end, that didn't work out either. And the British just ended up keeping the ship. So, yeah, it was a case of a certain amount of expediency. You've also got to remember that even in early 1918, at the time that the ship was purchased, there was a fair degree of supposition that the war might actually continue into 1919, potentially longer. So the British thought that they were at least going to get a decent amount of use out of her. And, of course, the longer they had her, the longer the original form of the ship would be less and less relevant to modern battleship politics, and therefore the Chileans might want to build something else with the money that the British had paid them. Warrant Officer Will asks, so what was the Mark 16 torpedo? Was it merely the term for the fixed Mark 14, or was it something else entirely? And if the latter, how did it go from being the Seawolf of torpedoes to being the primary torpedo of US submarines all the way through to the 70s before being replaced by the Mark 48. It's a little bit of both. So essentially the Mark 16 project started from some people going, yeah, that this Mark 14 thing, that's not really worked out for us. How about we just design a new torpedo? And this was a parallel effort to trying to fix the Mark 14. So it was kind of, you know, hedging your bets. Either we fix the Mark 14, in which case, great, or we don't, but if we don't, well, we've already got a replacement in mind. So the Mark 16 has exactly the same form factor as a Mark 14 because the outer shell is literally just a mid-run Mark 14 shell. But internally, it introduces a whole load of different things. It uses a completely different propulsion system, whereas the Mark 14 uses an alcohol-based propulsion system, which obviously was much beloved to submarine crews who could try and drain some of it off. As you can see here, the Mark 16 used what was called NAVOL, which is basically extremely concentrated hydrogen peroxide, not so much something you want to drink. And some of the advantages of this new propulsion system, which obviously then used a little turbine to run, was that although the Mark 16 had about the same speed through the water at high speed setting as compared to the Mark 14, it could go further than the Mark 14, and there was a little bit more space inside to fit a even larger warhead. So the Mark 16 was a more powerful torpedo than the Mark 14. It would hit with a bigger boom. Obviously, they could use a different exploder. And it would go further at high speed than the Mark 14 could go, pretty much period in almost all forms. So it was overall a better torpedo. It had some slight improvements in how you set things like depth and angle and so forth, but by and large it was designed to essentially just replace the Mark 14. So a lot of the external fixtures and fittings were identical because it had to fit in the torpedo tubes that had been designed to fire the Mark 14. Of course, the problem was that once they'd finished developing the Mark 16, or actually even slightly before that, they managed to fix most of the issues with the Mark 14, at which point you had a slightly more powerful, slightly longer range torpedo in the Mark 16, but one that was considerably more expensive to produce. Somewhat understandable, since you don't want the hydrogen peroxide just randomly detonating the torpedo. There's a Russian submarine or two in more recent times who have a lot to say about that. And so, although they produced, I think it was just under a couple of thousand of the things, and technically they were superior to the Mark 14, there was just a lot more Mark 14s around, so you had a mixture of Mark 14s and Mark 16s in service with the US Navy as anti-shipping torpedoes, because, well, why not? The things worked, they had a nice big warhead, and up until somebody developed a even faster, even more killy homing torpedo, well, you might as well keep them around, because remember, anti-surface and anti-submarine torpedoes for a good chunk of the Cold War were very different things. Robert Neal asks, did the American PT boats use the Mark 15 torpedo? It seems a rather large and heavy thing for use on such craft. Fortunately, I think for all concerned, no, the PT boats didn't use Mark 15 torpedoes. As you said, they would have been far too heavy to realistically carry and deploy in any significant amount on PT boats. Instead, the PT boats had their own lighter weight, shorter torpedo, the Mark 8, which rather confusingly was fired out of Mark 18 tubes. And of course, later on, there is a Mark 18 electric torpedo. So sometimes you see things getting a bit confused and people claiming the PT boats fired Mark 18 torpedoes because they think they're looking and go, oh, clearly a Mark 18 torpedo tube would fire a Mark 18 torpedo. In fact, the Mark 18 torpedo tube fires the Mark 8 torpedo, unhelpfully. And then even more unhelpfully, there were some experiments to see if you could get a PT boat to fire a Mark 18 torpedo. Spoiler alert, the thing weighing well over 3,000 pounds, it wasn't the most popular of experiments. But later on during the war, the PT boats, or quite a few of them, did actually end up swapping out from firing the Mark 8s to firing slightly modified versions of the Mark 13s, the US air-dropped torpedoes, because again, they're smaller and lighter weight than Mark 15s. The Gipper asks, I understand the issues with reverse engineering weapons, but in terms of torpedoes specifically, why were there so many reliability issues with American torpedoes when presumably significant amounts of research and potential examples would have been available from other designs that were successful? So there's kind of two separate issues. There's the Exploder, the infamous Mark 6, which obviously did cause a huge amount of issues, but issues with magnetic exploders weren't unique to the US Navy. Virtually everybody who tried them also had issues. They were just pretty much universally faster at fixing them than the US Navy, mostly because, to varying degrees, the other navies weren't in quite as much denial about the incapability of such weapons once the submarine commanders start saying, hey, this thing ain't working properly. But beyond that, there's also torpedo development. So if you compare and contrast US torpedo development with, let's say, British and Japanese torpedo development, because those are the other two really big navies and of the Second World War, the US has the Mark 10, which is a kind of mid to late World War I era torpedo. And to be perfectly honest, it's not, compared to other submarine launch torpedoes of the time, it's not a particularly brilliant torpedo. It's fairly short range and relatively slow. And they have the Mark 11 and the Mark 12 for surface ships. But that's basically it for a very, very long time. And then you get to the early 30s and they introduce the Mark 13, 14, 15 family. So there's a huge technological leap. I mean, you're talking almost two decades worth of technology advancement being crammed into a brand new set of torpedoes. And because of that, obviously the performance leap on paper from the Mark 10 is huge, but also proportional to something like a Mark 10, understandably, the cost of the new torpedoes is very large. So you get these torpedoes starting to enter service in the mid to late 1930s, and they're big, they're expensive, they've taken a lot of design work, they're ostensibly much better than the Mark 10 and associated torpedoes. And then you get the Bureau of Ordnance and so forth going, no, we can't test these things. These things cost $10,000 a shot. What are you on about? No, we can't destructively test them. You just have to trust us that all this fancy new gubbins works. And it turns out, well, it doesn't. A good chunk of the problems, not all of them, but a good chunk of the problems, especially when it came to the exploder, once you got rid of the magnetic influence issue, was the fact that the jump in torpedo speed was so great that, yeah, the Mark 6 contact exploder probably would have worked fine stuck on a Mark 10 torpedo, but when it was stuck on a torpedo that was going 10 to 15 knots faster, it just couldn't react fast enough before it distorted. Now, you go and look at the British, and the British start off, let's say, in the case of the Mark 14, so we're looking at submarine torpedoes, the British start off with a Mark 4, which is of approximately the same vintage as the Mark 10, albeit is still actually just a flat-out better torpedo in most respects. But then they developed the Mark 8 in the 1920s, middle of the 1920s, and they continue to iterate. So you get the Mark 8 and the Mark 8 Star. And yes, those Mark 8 torpedoes will go on to sink the General Belgrano in the 1980s. But partly because the British have been doing a lot of work with torpedoes in the interim, going from the Mark IV, obviously through air-launched and surface-launched torpedoes as well as submarine launch, their performance improvements have been more incremental so that they can identify issues. And also, they actually do testing. So where there are potential issues with higher-performance torpedoes, they're able to work them out, especially within a 15-year head start between the initial deployment of the Mark 8 and the start of World War II, they've got plenty of time to work out all of the problems. And similarly, the Japanese, around about the same time as the Mark 10, they have the Type 6. Then, in the middle of the interwar period, they replace that with the Type 89. And they continue to develop and iterate on their various torpedoes until, of course, in the mid to late 1930s, you get the introduction of the Type 95, the 21-inch version of essentially the Long Lance. And they also do full testing. So essentially, with Britain and Japan, they've developed torpedoes in more incremental steps and done thorough testing the whole way through, whereas the Americans have just gone from a fairly mediocre World War I torpedo and just gone straight into a mid-1930s torpedo, and they're not bothered to test to see if it actually worked properly. The Real T-Bert asks, I'm not sure if this was mentioned before, but what was the reasoning behind the Mark 6 exploder's firing pin placement? Being near perpendicular to the direction of travel makes no sense, considering the purpose of the exploder is to trigger an explosion on a thing designed to crash into something. Was this a conventional design for exploders at the time? It wasn't a entirely conventional design. The exact angle and nature of the detonator varied depending on the torpedo in question. So some torpedoes did have, if you like, perpendicular firing pins, like you see on the Mark 14. But as a rule, the ones that had such detonators tended to be slower weapons, so electric homing torpedoes, for example. And in those torpedoes, it wasn't so much of a problem because, well, obviously going at a slower speed, there's not as much lateral force being exerted, therefore it can successfully work. There's also the fact that the Mark 6 exploder is a combined exploder mechanism, so it has the impact fuse and the magnetic fuse, and both of those need to be able to set off the detonator, which makes the whole thing a lot more complicated, which in part, having looked at some other torpedo detonators in person, seems to have led to the Mark 6 having a somewhat longer path of travel for its firing pin than a number of other torpedo detonators, combined with the fact that it was on these two little thin aluminium guide rails, which of course could and did bend under the extreme forces being exerted, whereas on the PI-4C, which you saw me experiment with in the Friday video, that, although theoretically also a side-mounted thing, one, wasn't moving anywhere near as fast, and two, as you saw when the thing launched, it was entirely contained within a metal tube within the detonator. So in that initial deceleration, even if it had been going up 46 knots like a high-speed setting Mark 14, there wouldn't have been anywhere near the same level of instantaneous deformation going on, and it still would have been able to complete its travel. Other torpedoes, particularly torpedoes that were designed for fairly high speed, actually did have detonators that worked in the direction of travel. So, and quite often if you see torpedoes with what look like little propellers on the nose, those tend to be the arming propeller, kind of like the rubber propeller on the PI-4C, except obviously mounted on the nose rather than on the side. And those things are attached to a detonator mechanism, which is set somewhat back within the warhead. Usually, actually, the point of contact with the rest of the explosive is around about where the Mark 6 exploder theoretically should have done, because obviously when the torpedo hits something, there is a very slight delay while the mechanical part of the fuse sets off, and then the firing pin has to travel, strike the explosive, and the explosive goes boom. And in that time, there is going to be a bit of crumpling up front. So you don't want your detonator to be right at the very bow of the torpedo, because it'll probably get destroyed before it can finish firing. Whereas if you have the arming mechanism on the very bow, and then, you know, 6 inches further back, you have the actual detonator, that's enough space for the detonator to reliably work. So for the higher speed torpedoes, they tend to have more inline detonators. To be perfectly honest, I think if the Mark 6, even the way it was designed, had been designed with a slightly shorter travel path, perhaps having separate mechanical and magnetic fuse initiations with separate firing pins, yes, it would have made it slightly more complex and slightly more expensive, but you wouldn't have had to have had a system that can be set off by both, and thus perhaps it would have worked a little bit better. Christopher Rowe asks, when was the 1943 review of the Mark 13 completed, and when would it have been made available to naval aviation commands? For context, following the successful attack on German shipping off Bodø, Norway, by aircraft from USS Ranger during Operation Leader in early October 1943, I believe Admiral Bruce Fraser proposed a similar operation for November. This time, however, the US Navy Task Force commander, Rear Admiral Olaf Hustvedt, proposed the Ranger's Avengers would attack with torpedoes instead of masthead bombing, which had been decided on for Leader due to uncertainty regarding ample shipping targets and the narrowness of Norwegian leads. Of the Norwegian leads, I should say. My grandfather's memoirs make no mention of issues with aerial torpedoes, but I'm imagining him as a commander of the Ranger sheepishly explaining to the task force commander, about those torpedoes. The problems of the Mark 13 were fairly well known by the end of 1942, and as far as I can tell, the review of the issues in 1943 had mostly been completed. Certainly preliminary reports very much predate October. Now, there were some suggested fixes, and of course the thing you've always got to remember is that while the Mark 13, 14 and 15 torpedoes did have issues that made them unreliable, that didn't mean they didn't work entirely. Okay, fair enough, the Mark 14 almost didn't work entirely, but even the Mark 14 occasionally went off properly, and the Mark 13s, while they did have plenty of issues, didn't have quite the same dud rate, if you like, or failure rate, as the Mark 14s. There was, of course, the additional complication of the Mark 13s not necessarily wanting to enter the water quite correctly. But once the Mark 13s were actually in the water, I mean, there was still a good chance that it might just go off or doing its own thing, but it would work sometimes. And I suspect that when it comes to the proposed follow-up for Operation Leader, there would be a combination of factors. A number of the ships during Operation Leader that were hit had managed to beach themselves because they'd been badly bombed and were sinking, but obviously weren't sinking quite fast enough to stop them being at least partially saved. And so obviously you blow a big hole in a merchant ship with a torpedo, it's much more likely to go down. And of course, the other thing is, although they do have some defensive armament, merchant ships travelling along the Norwegian coast are a far easier target, both in terms of their speed and ability to evade, as well as the firepower they can put up to defend themselves, than warships, which would mean the Avengers would have much more opportunity to do textbook target attack runs, which would hopefully mitigate some of the issues with the Mark 13. And of course, the other thing is, with Leader having shown that there were relatively few merchant ships around to attack, if the Avenger drops a torpedo and the first one misses, well, three or four Avengers drop torpedoes, hopefully one of them will do its job, and you only need one to do the job, as opposed to targeting a warship where you might need three, four, five or more. But the pilots on Ranger and the various officers mostly should have been and probably were aware of some of the issues. So I suspect that any proposal to use torpedoes would have either been predicated on the fact that, yeah, they might fail a good chunk of the time, but in this environment, they'll probably fail slightly less, and we only need one successful hit per target, really. So it's a bit of a more ideal environment, combined with the fact that, well, as you say, it's entirely possible that Admiral Hustvedt maybe hadn't read that particular memo or paper, but other people had. Tommy Kaung asks, I heard that Russian seaplane carriers during World War II could launch 7 planes within 14 minutes. Considering British seaplane carriers at the same period required as much as 20 minutes to get one plane into the air, even with the catapult, were Russian crews really that good, or was there any doctrinal issue within the Royal Navy regarding seaplane carriers? Well, first of all, I'm pretty sure that the idea of a Russian seaplane carrier launching 7 planes within 14 minutes is complete nonsense. Not because it couldn't theoretically be done, but because although the Russian Black Sea Fleet did have a surprising number and interesting variety of seaplane carriers, like this one, for example, the vast majority of them couldn't carry 7 aircraft. It's very difficult to launch 7 planes in 14 minutes if the maximum number of aircraft you have aboard is 4, which was more typical for most of the Russian seaplane carriers. Now, to be fair, there were one or two that had an air group that, if you can call it that, was rated as between 6 and 9, or 4 and 9, depending on which book you're looking at. So in theory, those couple could be physically capable of launching 7 planes, period. But then you have to examine, could they do it within 14 minutes? Again, no, because as you can see, this is one of the more advanced of the Russian seaplane carriers. It's not the most advanced, but one of the most. And as you can see, it's got a little flight deck at the back, hangar up front. There's just no way that you're actually launching that many seaplanes in, well, that's basically 1 every 2 minutes. It's just not happening. How are you going to do this? You don't have the space to park them in advance of launching. I have a feeling, assuming that the claim wasn't just made up by somebody who hopes that nobody's actually going to check into these kind of things, which unfortunately, when it comes to claims of what the Russian Navy could do in World War One, that kind of, oh, we're just going to say this random thing that's better than everybody else's and hope no one actually bothers to check Russian language sources because they're difficult to find. That does happen a lot. Which is also actually, as a historian, not only annoying because it's usually false, but also annoying because there's a bunch of really cool stuff the Russian Imperial Navy did actually do in World War One, like forming the Conga Line of Death with their pre-dreadnoughts to see off Goeben and coordinating all their fire and everything. And that stuff's actually really cool. But then when you say to people, hey, the Russians worked out how to centralize the fire of multiple ships onto just one and used it to enable a bunch of pre-dreadnoughts to drive off German battle cruise, everyone goes, oh yeah, no, the Russians can't possibly have done that, because all this other stuff that people say the Russians can do is blatantly ridiculous. And they might be right about all the other stuff, but that particular achievement, the Russians did actually do, but people don't believe it because of all these other ridiculous claims. Now, that little rant over, if they were saying it in good faith, but perhaps were, shall we say, a little bit misinformed, or maybe missed something in translation, what I think that claim might come from is from, again, an actual Russian feat during World War One, which was to launch a mass seaplane carrier air raid on an Ottoman port in 1916, which, that's actually quite an impressive thing in and of itself. But when they did this, they launched, I think it was 13 or 14 seaplanes. from multiple seaplane carriers. They actually had a reasonable sized fleet of between 6 and 8 at any given time of seaplane carriers. So what someone might have read is that Russian seaplane carriers, plural, on that raid got their first 7 aircraft off within 14 minutes. That I could believe, because that would be several seaplane carriers all deploying their aircraft, and that, at that point they only need to deploy 1 or 2 aircraft each within the space of that 14 minutes, and yeah, then you've got 7 aircraft off into the skies within 14 minutes. Whereas someone's saying, oh no, there's a Russian seaplane carrier that essentially would have to be catapulting aircraft off to get 7 off in 14 minutes on its own, that's really not going to happen. And the reason why it took up to 20 minutes to get one plane in the air with some Royal Navy seaplane carriers is essentially because of the limitations of pretty much all seaplane carriers in that period, which is that very few were actually capable of launching seaplanes off of their bow or off of their stern, as you would do with a normal aircraft carrier. Quite a lot of seaplane carriers had to crane their seaplanes over the side and send them off that way and crane them back in again. And even the ones that could launch from a flight deck, like the first HMS Ark Royal, or the first 20th century HMS Ark Royal, I should say, even then, because of the limited size of the flight deck, you'd have your aircraft stored in the hangar or wherever, and then you'd have to bring that aircraft up, assemble it in, essentially, basically put the wings on, or unfold the wings, depending on the aircraft in question, then warm it up, do your maintenance checks, get it running, and off it goes. And then you have to repeat the process. And obviously, if you're launching the aircraft from the sea, then you have to get it out of the hangar, assemble it, check it. Okay, fine, great, it's all done. Now we have to crane it over the side, and then it gets going. And if you're moving at the time, like, say, the seaplane carrier that managed to get an aircraft up in the air at Jutland, if you're moving, then you start with, okay, well, we're getting our aircraft up and out of the hangar to prepare it for launch, but we also have to slow down, potentially stop, in order to get that aircraft over the side, which if you're moving at 15, 20 knots, that might take a little bit of time as well. And so all of that is going to lengthen your operational time. And so, you know, if a bunch of seaplane carriers, let's say in the Black Sea, have all motored up to a target area, they've all come to a nice stop or just maintaining steerage, and then they go, right, well, we're basically in launch position, now we're going to start getting the aircraft up, out, prepared, in the water and away, then you can, yeah, you could, at that point, you could maybe get a couple of aircraft up and away, especially if you had one maybe already up on deck waiting. You could get a couple of aircraft away in a quarter of an hour, whereas if you're running at full speed with Grand Fleet and you go, oh, hang on, I need to pull over and launch a seaplane, that might take 20 minutes just to get the one plane in the air. And basically these problems with seaplane carriers is why the full flight deck aircraft carrier with wheeled aircraft was invented. Daniel Taylor asks, I'm listening to a podcast with an author of a book on U-boats in World War II who said that scurvy was a problem on U-boats in World War II. I've never heard of that before. Have you come across it? Yes, scurvy does show up in some U-boats. It's not a 100% thing. Like, you know, if you go on a U-boat, you will get scurvy. It very much depends on what kind of U-boat you're on, what area you're assigned to patrol, and how long you're out for. So, obviously, the risks of things like scurvy had been known about, and the cures for it known for quite a while. However, in one of the best ways to cure scurvy or to prevent it, even in the early 20th century, is simply to consume enough fresh fruit and maybe one or two types of vegetable that contain vitamin C, or get rationed with lemon juice or lime juice or something like this. The problem is, unless you're doing something like issuing everybody 5 drops of lemon juice a day or something from a sealed container, most of that stuff is, relatively speaking, fresh food and can spoil quite quickly. Now, on most ships that might not, like a destroyer that's not going to be at sea for too long, that's not a problem. They can always have fresh food available. And even on a battleship, a carrier cruiser that's out for quite a bit longer, then they'll still have decent stocks of fresh food. And of course, they have large refrigerated areas which can keep fresh food fresh for considerably longer. So they don't have so much of an issue. On a submarine, however, you have a little bit of a problem because you can't afford massive refrigeration rooms. And any fresh food that you take on board has to actually be consumed pretty darn quickly because submarines are usually quite warm, quite humid, and therefore something like, I don't know, fresh lemons or limes or oranges or something will rot and mold extremely fast, which means that very soon you're down to just canned foods. Now, of course, that can include canned and preserved fruit, which will still have its anti-scurvy properties, which is quite useful for obvious reasons. However, even then, you have a little bit of a potential issue because some forms of preservation actually destroy or significantly reduce the amounts of vitamin C, and you've got to rely on actually consuming those things on a regular basis, even assuming that they're preserved in a way that preserves most or all of the vitamin C content. You've got to space those things out. And as anybody who's been on a submarine in active service will tell you, food gets packed absolutely everywhere, and it tends to be consumed on the basis of what is accessible at this point. You know, if there's a huge stack of food on a U-boat under the deck gratings, then, well, they'll be like, okay, we'll lift up this deck grating. These cans are what we're going to have for the next few days. And then we'll put that one back. We'll lift up this deck grating. And now these cans are the ones we're going to have for the next few days. Now, if someone's been really clever and gone, okay, I'm going to have, I don't know, every 10th or 20th can is going to be a nice big can of preserved fruit, and so evenly spaced throughout all your rations, then yeah, everyone's going to be getting preserved fruit on a regular basis. And then again, assuming it's the type that has preserved, it's been preserved in a way that preserves its vitamin C, you won't get scurvy. But if the U-boat's been loaded in such a way where people have just gone, okay, right, here's the tins of sauerkraut, right, they go there. Here's the tins of sausage, they go there. Here's the tins of fresh or preserved fruit, tinned fruit, right, they go there. And here's the tins of, I don't know, tinned potatoes or something, they go over there. Well, you'll burn through your fresh supplies, then you might not have any fruit for, let's say, a week. And then for the next 3 or 4 days, as they work their way through, they'll be like, ah, and now we get to the bit where there's tons of fruit. Everyone, guess what? You're having a bunch of fruit for the next 4 or 5 days. And that might be fine, except then you've eaten pretty much all the preserved fruit. And now you've still got, you know, you're still on patrol for 2-3 weeks or so. And towards the end of that, you've now not had any vitamin C rich foods for quite a while. And now you will start developing scurvy. And of course, that's going to be perhaps somewhat hidden initially by all the other nasty stuff that you can pick up being in a U-boat crew for extended periods of time due to, well, you're in a small metal cylinder with a bunch of other people in a hot, humid environment. There's going to be a bunch of other interesting skin conditions and illnesses that you're going to be picking up at that point. And so people might not notice the scurvy symptoms until they really start to take predominance. And as I say, it's not just a case of how long a voyage you're on, but it's also where you're on a voyage to in terms of the location. Because, you know, if you're operating in the Arctic, going after Arctic convoys, well, one, your voyages probably aren't going to be as long. You're going to go out, attack a convoy or two, come back again, and the journey to or from is fairly quick. So, one, you're much more likely to have added access to fresh fruit relatively recently. But two, your U-boat has just become a gigantic refrigerator. So your fresh food is going to probably last considerably longer. Whereas if you've been sent in a Type 7 packed to the gills with everything, including additional fuel, and told, okay, you have to go and attack stuff off of the Florida Keys, so you're going to be at sea for weeks and weeks and weeks on end in a hot, humid environment where you're now essentially in a mold central, yeah, you're probably going to get scurvy at some point on that mission, unless your captain's been very clever about things. John McDonough asks, in many of your recent videos, you've mentioned a number of the mad lads, i.e. Cochrane, Hawke, Nelson, basically anyone who was a destroyer captain, whose hyper-aggressiveness led to victory, advancement, and seemingly eternal glory. My question is, who are the naval equivalents of George Armstrong Custer or Colonel Ichiki, I think? These would be men whose response to any tactical situation was to attack no matter what the opposition was, how many there were, or even where they were, because whichever nation they served had to, of course, be the best, and all they had to do was show up and they'll win automatically, usually failing horribly. Any naval equivalent I can think of, for example, Craddock at Coronel, Arbuthnot at Jutland, Yamaguchi at Midway, and even Xerxes at Salamis, all have mitigating factors beyond the sheer arrogance of the commander involved. So have I just answered my own question, and that there are no naval equivalents of these individuals? It's somewhat difficult to find naval officers like that. You know, there, as you said, there are very aggressive, in fact, as you mentioned, hyper-aggressive commanders, especially people like Cochrane, who, to a great degree, are somewhat mad, but theirs is a qualified kind of madness wherein they prepare for almost any eventuality. They're extremely quick in their thinking, and they also tend to size up the situation, work out what the potential pitfalls are, and come up with mitigations for those pitfalls in their heads, even if they don't necessarily tell everyone what they're doing at the time, which means that when they then go ahead to engage in actions that are fairly reckless, they have, however, at least come up with counters or contingencies for most of the more immediate and obvious problems with what they're doing, which kind of helps with the fact that they then tend to succeed quite a bit. The kind of person who just sees something and attacks all the time, regardless of any other consideration, usually will get weeded out either by his superior officers or by flying shrapnel, one way or the other, relatively early in their career. And because a naval career requires usually a fair amount of time before you're given a command, and in the period when perhaps you could get a command somewhat earlier, like the Napoleonic Wars, there's a lot more direct judgment by immediate superiors going on. And therefore, that kind of extremely reckless officer would get reported by his superiors or by his crew, for that matter, or his department later on. And they probably wouldn't be given the command in the first place. Now, some will inevitably slip through the cracks, but they will usually tend to be in command of smaller ships who are then under the subordinate command of larger vessels. And if they do end up dying through extreme aggression, no one really blinks much of an eye because, well, they were part of a much larger engagement and some losses are expected. When you move up to the category of large vessels, so cruisers, battleships, in later periods, rated vessels, ships of the line, in earlier periods, as I say, normally that kind of officer has been eliminated very early on, so it's very difficult to find examples. Usually, when you see the kind of example of that kind of officer, it's usually someone from slightly further back in time who has been put in position because of political favour or because of social connections, not necessarily because they have any great experience as a naval commander. Whereas obviously later on, even if you have political connections and favours, like Beatty in World War One, you still have to have a naval career to back that up. And even Beatty wasn't dumb enough to try and fight the entirety of the high seas fleet, even if he was pretty terrible at signalling everyone else that he intended to run. But an example of that kind of officer would be, I believe it's pronounced Won Kyun. Apologies to South Korean listeners, or that like one guy in North Korea who's managed to get around the Great Firewall. And he seems to be essentially that kind of officer. He's parachuted in to replace Admiral Yi after Admiral Yi is dismissed because he refuses to take his fleet into suicidal waters. And Won Kyun takes his fleet into said suicidal waters. And so the carefully husbanded and built up Korean fleet that Admiral Yi has spent so many years trying to resuscitate gets completely smashed by the Japanese, who, you know, had laid a trap, and Admiral Yi had went, yes, that's a trap, I'm not going to sail into there. And Won Kyun went, I don't care, I'm going to sail into there. And shockingly, it was a trap, and, well, the Korean fleet got pretty much annihilated. And poor old Admiral Yi was then brought back and told, oh yeah, by the way, you're back to just over a dozen ships again. Have fun. Dubsington asks, in July and August of 1945, Third Fleet and the Royal Navy battleships present bombarded the Japanese home islands. I feel like not enough attention has been given to the remarkable spectacle of fast battleships steaming just a couple of miles offshore of enemy core territory, flattening city blocks. They had various goals, damaging factories, drawing off kamikazes, diverting defenders north, etc., with varying degrees of success. But it was also, to my knowledge, the last time the Royal Navy fired battleship guns in anger. Can you tell us a bit about this under-documented operation? Well, I covered some of the bombardment operations in my closing videos on the British Pacific Fleet, for obvious reasons, because King George V, as seen here, was part of said fleet. Now, the results of the operations, as he said, varying degrees of success. Some areas were actually very well hit, others not so much. A lot of it depended on the weather, because while obviously by 1945 everybody involved had radar-directed gunnery, that's great for ships at sea, not so great when you're targeting the land, because the land will just reflect radar all over the place. And the radar generally didn't have the fine discrimination to go, well, that building, this little echo here, that's the building you want to target, whereas this echo over here that looks very similar but is in a different position, that's actually a completely different structure, if indeed you could even discern those things at all. Obviously, the somewhat mountainous terrain of Japan making things even more complicated. So the battleships tended to use a mixture of aerial spotting and visual spotting from the rangefinders and so forth, plus some other electronic aids and maps to plot their bombardments. But of course, that meant that if you had poor visibility conditions, the level of accuracy on the gunnery could be affected quite badly. Now, with that said, the bombardments were actually considerably more effective than the immediate apparent effectiveness seemed to be. Because, of course, bombs, when they're dropped, tend to, for the most part in that time period, explode pretty much on contact with something. So if you drop bombs on a factory, they'll hit the roof or the walls or the ground next to the factory, they'll blow up. There'll be big visible craters, big holes punched in the buildings. It looks very spectacular. And of course, it doesn't have particularly brilliant effects on the people inside or the equipment. Whereas battleship shells, obviously, if you're using AP, they're punched clean through a wall very easily. And even a base fused high explosive shell will easily punch through a brick wall or a window or a sheet roof or something like that and detonate inside. That might very well end up doing more damage to the interior, but much less damage to the actual structure itself. And thus, initial aerial observation went, oh, those buildings look surprisingly intact. But post-war observation went, the building's intact. The interior, not so much. So there was that. But the bombardments actually had two other rather important effects. The first was it was very demoralizing for the Japanese population, not just because it wasn't just the factories that were hit. Obviously, the near misses tended to blow up a lot of things. But the simple fact was that an air raid tended to come and go, and there was still kind of the implication that, well, this air raid is taking place, yes, but the enemy are very far away, which is why they have to send these long-range bombers to get us. Whereas a shore bombardment will go on for several hours, much more prolonged, and you can physically see the enemy ships right there off the coast, which is far more demoralizing because it implies, correctly as it turns out, that there's precious little the Japanese armed forces can do to stop them. That was mostly a combination of one, well, the Japanese didn't have any forces really capable of taking on half a dozen battleships at that point. And two, even if they had tried to sortie with, say, Nagato or whatever, they just plain didn't have the fuel. And the same reason they weren't sending out mass kamikaze swarms and so forth at that stage. To be fair, they were saving up what fuel they had left for a mass kamikaze attempt when the anticipated Allied landings took place. But if you're a Japanese citizen, you're not being told all that. What you're seeing is, well, there's a bunch of enemy battleships a few miles offshore shooting up our city, and there's nothing being done about it. The other big factor, of course, was also risk, because even at this stage late in the war, if you sent in carrier-based aircraft or long-range bombers, even assuming they hit their targets, when the target was smaller than a city, the simple fact was that those bombers were still at risk. They could still be shot down by anti-aircraft fire or Japanese fighters, and indeed they were being shot down and attacked by Japanese fighters and anti-aircraft guns right up until the very end of the war. So even if you could argue that perhaps the bombing, especially by naval dive bombers, for instance, might be a little bit more effective in terms of a, you know, tonnage of explosive flung the enemy's way perspective, it was a significant risk to Allied airmen's lives, whereas the battleships could sail up and down the Japanese coast by summer 1945, and as I said, there was precious little the Japanese could do to stop them, so it was a near enough risk-free operation. Now, of course, you might have the occasional Japanese submarine or something try something, but that's what escorts are for. Nick Brodar asks, what was the purpose of the oddly shaped forward funnel on the Soviet Gangut-class rebuilds? Basically, it was there to get smoke away from the bridge superstructure and the mast, or the foremast at least. So you can see here, this is Gangut in at the front. There's Petropavlovsk, Poltava and Sevastopol further back, but the Gangut-class anyway. Here's Gangut up front, and as you can see in her original configuration, she's got two big funnels, and one is right up behind the bridge superstructure, and it's vertical. But it doesn't matter so much, I guess, unless you're in the foretop, in which case it probably does matter somewhat, but for the bridge and the other parts of the forward superstructure, such as they are, the Ganguts, as originally built, have very minimal superstructure above the main deck. The fact that funnel is vertical doesn't really make much odds, because as you can see, it's 15, 20 feet taller than the forward bridge superstructure. So even if the smoke's coming straight up, it's still well clear of said bridge. But then fast forward to her being Oktyabrskaya Revolutsiya, I think, or as I call her, Dance Dance Soviet Revolution. Now you can see there's an awful lot more bridge superstructure having been built up, rangefinders, fire control equipment, the command and control, etc., etc. So, and you can also actually see where the aft funnel is, and from the previous picture we know that the two funnels are approximately the same height, so if you imagine where that funnel would be in this massive forward superstructure, it would obviously then be venting huge amounts of smoke into the upper works of the bridge tower, if you'd want to call it that, especially because that said bridge tower would be creating a whole load of dead air and vortexes immediately behind it, which would kind of suck all the smoke close in to it. So that's not brilliant. And so rather than relocate the funnel, which they can't really do, because as you can see, there's one of the main battery turrets immediately behind it, and there's another main battery turret immediately behind the next funnel, the Soviets just went, okay, we'll put this stylish rake onto the funnel and extend it a little bit. And that way, that is obviously inducing a rearwards velocity to the smoke, plus elevating it slightly higher and separating it a bit more from the bridge and the rest of the tower superstructure. And thus, hopefully, that will mean that when the funnel starts exhausting smoke and hot gases, they won't immediately incinerate everybody in the upper part of the bridge and, well, bridge tower. Duke Master asks, a simple one since this will be answered close-ish to April Fool's Day. What is the worst ship you secretly love and the best ship you absolutely can't stand? Either the ship's engineering and design or its intended use. So I guess a guilty pleasure of mine in some ways would be this, the Victoria class, specifically HMS Sans Pareil here. Now, objectively speaking, while they are quite interesting, you know, engineering accomplishments, objectively speaking, they're pretty terrible warships. Not because they're poorly protected or anything like that. They're, you know, for their time period, they're fairly well protected, in fact, very well protected. And they've got, as you can see, a secondary battery. They've got a reasonable turn of speed, but they rely entirely on two absolutely gargantuan guns up front. Now, the whole style and design ethos of this kind of, you know, one turret with couple of big guns up front and everything else is subsidiary to that. I kind of like the aesthetic. And the Royal Navy does build a number of other ships that are of a similar layout, mostly coastal defense vessels. However, I've got to admit that compared to a lot of other vessels of the time, these are very much coin toss vessels in an actual fight. Now, the secondary battery gives them something to do during a battle, but with those two guns, you're essentially going, okay, if these two guns hit you, you're really, really in trouble. However, they are only two guns and they take forever and a day to reload, so we're going to fire at you now. And assuming that you survive that, then there is a reasonably decent chance we're going to miss with our first salvo. We will now lightly pepper you with our battery of 6-inch guns for an extended period of time while we, you know, communicate, have tea, read a magazine, read a book, write a journal, and then at approximately sunset, we may have actually reloaded the main guns again, and then we'll have another crack at you. Assuming that in that intervening time, you haven't, you know, sailed 16 times around us and hit us with your own slightly faster reloading guns. But there you go. Now, obviously, I exaggerate a little bit for comic effect, but it is notable that pretty much the only major accomplishment of the Victoria class was getting sunk by Camperdown. A little bit of personal bias as well, because the Sanspry was at one point commanded by a distant relative of mine about 5 generations back. But there's that as well, I guess. And yes, for those of you who ask, or those of you who already know, he was appropriately pyromaniacal. And as for a well-built ship, or good ship, I guess you could call it, that I absolutely can't stand, I actually had to sit and think for a long while, because I've got time for pretty much any decent warship, even the ones whose fans are very annoying. And I don't count Bismarck in that category, because as you know, to me, she's an okay warship, but she's very inefficiently designed, so she doesn't count in the good category, more of the meh category. But eventually I came to the conclusion that if there is, you know, going through all the ships that I would consider to be fairly well designed by their time period, which one makes me just go, oh, not that again? And eventually I came down to the Baden or Bayern class, as you see here. Not because there's anything particularly wrong with the ships themselves. You know, they're pretty decent. But because there is a small but annoying sect of people who seem to believe that just because something came from Germany, it must therefore be superior to everything else ever built at the time and forevermore. And, I mean, there's a lot louder group of those people when it comes to Bismarck, but as I said, I don't count Bismarck as a good ship to start with. Whereas the Bayern and Baden and, by extension, Sachsen and Württemberg, they're not bad ships at all. They're, you know, they're not quite as good as the Queen Elizabeth's, objectively speaking, but they're a pretty solid entry in the overall super dreadnought category. But this small vocal group of people, you know, the minute you see them mentioned at all in almost anywhere, they'll always chime in with, ah, yes, well, these ships are clearly superior to any of the British 15-inch armed ships, and if Germany had just managed to complete Sachsen and Württemberg, they could have won the war, or if they'd built all four of them, then they could have faced off and defeated the 5th Battle Squadron at the Battle of Jutland, and so on and so forth. And I just sit and go, no, please stop. You know, you're so horribly objectively wrong if you took a minute to actually read a book, assuming, of course, you can read, which may be a bit beyond some of them, you'd realise that, you know, they're good, they're not Uber ships. You know, this is not the Ubermensch of steel, unfortunately. And while you do get, you know, similar-ish fanboys for things like Iowa and Yamato and so on and so forth, one, you can make a much more justified argument for Iowa or Yamato being a super ship than you can for Bayern or Baden. And two, there's much larger fan groups for Yamato and Iowa. So the extremely loud and obnoxious people with room temperature IQs and the reading ability of a sheep tend to be in the extreme minority. Whereas, sadly, in my opinion, there aren't quite as many fans of Bayern and Baden because they're not awful ships. They're pretty good and interesting designs. which then means that the relatively small number of loudmouths tend to drown out the like five people who turn up and say, actually, I quite like the ship, but they're not particularly world-ending vessels. Brian Nicholas asks, how did Britain deal with the German Zeppelin terror bombings in World War One? And did Britain or the Entente have an airship force of their own in World War One? So the latter part, yes. Britain especially had quite a large fleet of airships during World War One, but they weren't rigid Zeppelin-style airships like the Germans had. The British did have a handful of rigid airships, but they didn't really do all that much with them. The vast, vast, vast majority of British airships were non-rigid or semi-rigid airships, a lot of them used by the Royal Navy, mostly for patrol work, which they did pretty well at. As far as how did Britain deal with the German terror bombings via the Zeppelins during World War One, it was a bit of a mixed bag. Probably in some ways better covered by an aerial historian or a historian of military aircraft. But broadly speaking, initially, apart from obviously the slight nervousness of people looking up because there wasn't any real response available in at first, there was actually a little bit of a tussle in terms of responsibility for defence, because up until that point, defence of Britain's shores had been the responsibility of the Royal Navy, not the Army or the Royal Flying Corps, because the Royal Flying Corps had just been formed. So with pretty much all the Royal Flying Corps out supporting the Army, and indeed an aspect of the Army, the argument went that, well, home defence is the responsibility of the Royal Navy, and you know these are enemy airships, they're passing over the British coastline, therefore the Royal Navy should be the one to stop them. And then, obviously, the Royal Navy is saying, well, yeah, okay, the Royal Naval Air Service can have a crack at them, but also the Royal Flying Corps has by far the more aircraft, and these are flying threats, so maybe the Royal Flying Corps should help out. After that initial tussle, actually, the RNAS and the RFC both got together, and between them and some ground crews with early anti-aircraft guns and searchlights, they started to put together a relatively comprehensive system of anti-Zeppelin defence, such as could be mounted at the time. So you are obviously some blackouts, as I said, ground-based anti-aircraft fire, searchlights, spotting systems, and various intriguing ideas about how to stop the Zeppelins. Once they managed to come up with some aircraft that could actually fly as high as them, there were ideas about dropping darts and bombs on top of the Zeppelins to destroy them that way. If you go to Fleet Air Arm Museum in Yeovilton, they've got an aircraft there that was equipped with a whole bunch of rockets. So the idea was, you know, fly towards the Zeppelin and fire a bunch of explosive rockets at it. And all of this was because, well, riddling it with rifle caliber bullets, even if you put some incendiary rounds or tracer rounds in there, tended to take an awful lot of ammunition to do anything significant, even to a hydrogen-filled Zeppelin. And of course, the Germans responded with faster and higher climbing Zeppelins, but eventually the defence efforts did start to pay off and a number of Zeppelins were shot down or badly damaged. However, that also gives me an opportunity to recount another interesting family anecdote. So on my dad's side, my grandmother's grandfather, so my great-great-grandfather on my paternal side, but then on my grandmother's line, he lived in Woolwich at the time, and when one of the early Zeppelin raids showed up, my grandmother, back when I was younger, told me the story that had been passed down to her by her father, my great-grandfather, and that was as a young teenager, his father, so my great-great-grandfather, had heard that there was a Zeppelin coming, a German airship was coming to and was going to bomb things, because, well, it's the East End of London, and it usually cops a few bombs in most wars that Britain fights in the 20th century, unfortunately. But he decided, okay, well, everyone else is running, panicking and screaming and looking for shelter, but I don't see much point in this, because there's no such thing as an air raid shelter. So if you do get randomly bombed, well, whether you're hiding in the library or in a house or wherever, it's probably not going to make up the blindest bit of difference. So him and his son decided, well, he decided, brought his son along with him, we're going to go and watch. So they went to the park, which had a hill in it, and climbed up to the top of the hill, Because, of course, the Zeppelins are very big, very obviously incoming, but not particularly swift in at this point in the war. And this was one of the daylight raids. And they just stood there with some snacks on, and then found a park bench and sat down and watched, and just watched the thing kind of float vaguely in their general direction, be vaguely attacked by various things, and then retreat eventually. And, of course, yeah, his logic being that, well, if you're on the top of the hill in a park, that's the one place the Zeppelin's probably not going to try and bomb. And so you're not going to be intentionally killed. And as I said, pretty much anywhere else, you could be unintentionally killed. So might as well make a day of it while you can. And well, given the fact that I'm here, clearly he was correct. He was not, in fact, bombed by the random wandering Zeppelin. And finally for this week, GFDX asks, in naval history circles, there are differing opinions. Sometimes there is a commonly held belief, but there is a minority that believes something else. Are there any subjects where you have a minority held belief? I guess that's probably... it depends on how you define naval history circles. Because... if you want to talk about opinions of naval historians of various descriptions, then what constitutes a commonly held or minority held belief amongst them is quite often, disturbingly often actually, a very different thing to what is a commonly held belief or minority held belief in the wider circle of people who have some kind of passing interest in naval history and some level of claimed expertise one way or the other. So, for example, if you look at a very common one, HMS Hood, there's a disturbing number of people in the wider I'm interested in naval history to some degree or other circle who still are, for some reason, convinced that Hood was destroyed either by plunging fire, like a, you know, that with that infamous diagram, like if Hood's been fired up by a gigantic mortar shot or something, or else in combination with some idea that Hood was destroyed because she had all her magazine doors open and nothing had been learned from Jutland. Never mind the fact that that's probably not the direct cause of the losses of all of the British vessels at Jutland. It may have been a contributing factor to some, but certainly not all of the big capital ships, as I've gone into in other videos. But if you tighten that down to, you know, actual naval historians, practically nobody, I think, in that circle will give that those kinds of theories the time of day. And so, you know, what in the naval history circles, what I would define as naval historian circles, is a commonly held belief, which is that those things didn't destroy Hood, is a minority-held belief, or so appears, in the wider circle of things. So if I was to confine myself to the closer circle, so either naval historians or naval historians and naval historian-adjacent individuals, I would say maybe a couple of beliefs, I would say maybe minority-held beliefs, would be one I'm fairly sure that Britain could have afforded the G3 and N3 program if they had had to, or if they'd really wanted to. Now, that's a relatively minority held belief because, to be perfectly honest, as one of the many programs that was cut short by the Washington Naval Treaty, it doesn't get afforded a huge amount of time in various written works, but you usually will find something on the sign-off along the lines of, well, Britain was broke after World War I and couldn't have afforded them anyway. And that's pretty much that. Now, that's not necessarily completely common across the board, but there's a reasonable number of published works and naval historians who would give you something along those lines. Whereas, as I pointed out in various other videos before, Britain had a big national debt after World War I, yes, but she wasn't broke in the way that you could quite more convincingly argue she was broke after World War II. And in fact, you know, theoretically, Britain isn't broke now, yet our national debt goes up every year. The supposedly broken Britain of the early 1920s was paying down its national debt by significant percentage points each year during the early 1920s, basically before the Great Depression and all of that kicked off. And when you look at just how much money they were paying off, the costs of the G3 and N3 programs could easily be absorbed by diverting some of that money to paying for them, while still paying off a very large chunk of what they historically paid off anyway. And I would say actually another minority held belief in those kind of circles would be my theory that the county class was definitively built for, but not with, armor protection across as a full belt, i.e. you know, they designed the ships to be able to take this upgrade without significantly impacting their capabilities in the way that you would otherwise expect them to. And to be fair, I would say that's probably a minority held belief, largely because most naval historians I've spoken to just haven't really thought about it much before, because it doesn't seem to be all that important in the face of the much larger and more egregious violations of the naval treaties. And again, to be fair, when I've raised the idea with various naval historians and explained my reasoning, most of them are like, actually, no, you know what? That makes a certain amount of sense. But as with most good historians, they'll admit, yeah, it's a decent theory, but we still need some written proof. And, well, that written proof is part of my ongoing quest to try and find the county class design documents and various bits of correspondence and see if I can nail down if it was considered or minuted or anything like that. Of course, the slight complication with that is that if they were specifically designing a technically in some ways treaty-breaking cruiser, they would probably go to significant lengths to conceal the fact that they had done so, which would mean finding the exact correspondence would be a little bit tougher than finding the general correspondence. But, you know, my quest goes on. And that brings us to an end to this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much for listening, everyone, if indeed you still are, and I hope to see you again in another video soon. Bye for now.